Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. A proposal to make online sports betting legal in Wisconsin doesn't make it to the assembly floor. Plus, former Republican Attorney General Brad Schimmel is sworn in as an interim U.S. attorney. And wedding barn owners have lost their legal fight against new liquor licensing laws. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for November 21st. I'm Anjuvan Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Welcome to Rewind. We have a really busy week this week. We will start with Brad Schimmel, former Attorney General, of course, former candidate for the state Supreme Court, has been appointed the interim U.S. Attorney for Eastern Wisconsin. So that happened earlier this week. But this came out of an unusual process. Normally, the way that federal judges are appointed in Wisconsin follows its own unique process. There's a bipartisan nominating commission. This time around, it did not follow that approach. He was appointed directly by U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi, and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has reported that he actually texted Bondi directly about the job. So talk a little bit about what happened with the nominating commission.
So the commission, three appointees from Tammy Baldwin, three from Ron Johnson. It's been used since the 1970s by Wisconsin senators to identify candidates for judgeships, U.S. attorney, U.S. marshal. To get on the list of candidates before the White House, you have to have support from five of the six. Now, these deliberations are secret. We don't get to see like a vote or anything like that. But I talked to Brad Schimmel this week. He told me that he talked to some people, wouldn't say who they were, who told him that he had support from the Republican picks, i.e. Ron Johnson's, and that he fell short of the five needed to be a candidate. I got a letter from Tammy Baldwin's office that showed the chairs of the commission, actually it notified the senators in mid-August, they had failed to produce any candidates for the Eastern District or the Western District, both have openings there. Fast forward, it's been a couple of months, now we have the Bondi situation where she appoints them. These appointments are good for 120 days. So Brad Schimmel said in a statement he wants to remove that interim tag and basically become a full-time person. To do that, he has to get the support of the district judges in the Eastern District. So if he does a good job, in theory, they'll sign off. He can be U.S. attorney going through the rest of Trump's term. What's interesting to note, though, is kind of this commission process and the failure to produce a candidate. If you think about it, it's not a surprise that Tammy Baldwin's picks wouldn't be a big fan of having a U.S. attorney who is a former Republican attorney general, former circuit court judge in Waukesha, former Supreme Court candidate who embraced Donald Trump, the big bear hug, just this spring, trying to get his supporters out to help him win the election. So she had a scathing statement that this is he has no business being anywhere near this job, but she has no power to stop it. So my next question is, okay, we have this, the Eastern District. What about the Western, based in Madison? Haven't heard any news about that one. They keep going the interim appointment for the time being, or an acting U.S. attorney. But for right now, Brad Schimmel's based on a 129 job interview to prove himself worthy of staying on this job, according to the judges in that district.
Right, and that sort of that scathing statement from the Baldwin team saying that this is a failure of the nominating commission comes just weeks after the success of the nominating commission in getting Rebecca Tableson onto the Seventh Circuit. And she is a conservative pick. She was not backed by Baldwin, but there was this kind of emphasis, I think, between both Johnson and Baldwin on kind of keeping the norms going of this commission. And so the breakdown just a couple weeks later is really kind of notable. And as you say, this appointment is 120 days. It's interim, and then district judges will decide if he continues. And notably, Schimmel says that he won't prosecute any cases during that 120 days, basically, until he is made permanent. And so that's as, you know, some significant cases are moving forward, including Hannah Duggan in Milwaukee. And so he won't be touching that case for at least a couple of months.
He told me that with 120 days, you can't. Like, federal cases often take a long time to get to court. So he can't really insert himself in these cases. He said he's going to advocate on budgetary issues, staffing issues, or kind of keep himself to that. Worth noting with this commission, it's designed to produce consensus candidates. So what I mean by that is, so Rebecca Tableson, she's a conservative, but she had great credentials. I mean, she was a U.S. attorney, She clerked for, I think, at least one U.S. Supreme Court justice, if not two. Like, she had the background. You couldn't say anything besides her views being a problem for if you were on the commission. Schimmel, apparently a different story for members, but if you look at the judges in the district, I'm bringing this up because the judges in the Eastern District, they're all kind of consensus picks. Yes, there is Judge Ludwig, who is a Trump nominee or appointment, but he also ruled against Donald Trump in 2020 in his challenge to the Wisconsin election results. So they aren't really truly Trump or Biden or Obama or picks. They're kind of more like these consensus candidates. So it'll be interesting to see how Schimmel does and how the judges receive his or review his work the next 120 days.
Moving on to the legislature, lots happened in the legislature this week. Dozens of bills passed, both the Senate and Assembly. They're both in session. But we're going to start actually by talking about a couple of the things that did not happen at the legislature. Most notably, we were all kind of waiting for this bill about placing bets, online bets, to reach the floor of the Assembly. And then day of, it got pulled from the calendar, which was really quite notable. And so what this would have done is essentially allowed people to place online bets on sporting events and other kinds of events through their phones, as is quite popular these days, but the servers would still have to be held on tribal lands. And so this has gotten a lot of pushback, both from FanDuel and DraftKings, these kind of national outfits that say that that precludes them from participating in the state. It also got a lot of conservative pushback that said that this is kind of a legal and constitutional mess, that there are state, federal, and Indian law considerations all at play here. So there was a lot of pushback from Will and other kind of prominent conservative voices. So day of Assembly session on Wednesday, we kind of like got the news just a little bit ahead that it wasn't making it to the floor.
So I talk about the onion a lot of times, stuff in the Capitol. Here's a really big onion. So let's start with the policy piece of it. Wisconsin opened the door to Indian gaming back in the 80s because our state constitution says no gaming is allowed, period. But starting in the mid-60s, we began as voters to relax those restrictions. That included an 87 amendment to allow a state lottery. Federal courts later ruled if you allow a lottery, you must allow tribes to have gaming on reservation land. That led to the compacts that Tommy Thompson signed late 80s, early 90s. Jim Doyle came in 2003, greatly expanded those compacts to include Las Vegas-style games like craps and roulette. And then we have the situation now where we're moving toward this is the next frontier. If you are a fan of FanDuel's or DraftKings, and you are in Illinois, I believe, you will be able to access that app and place your bet. You cross the state line, a message will pop up saying you can't place a bet, not legal here. I know this for my friends who are degenerates who will know what state they're in when they game. So there's a policy piece of it. The question is it fair to allow the tribes to only have this option? Why don't we allow FanDuel and DraftKings to do this? Well, because the compacts. You can't grant anybody else the ability to game in Wisconsin unless you change the Constitution. If you change the Constitution, you would then negate the compacts, which would end the tribal payments to the state, which also if there were these tribes saying, we want our money back from past payments, it could be quite a quandary. Now, Wisconsin for Law and Liberty argues that the foundation of gaming in Wisconsin is unconstitutional as it is because it grants exclusivity to a group of people based on race, i.e. the tribes. Now, to address that, you need federal court decisions, so let's not even get into that. The whole amendment idea of like open door to everybody doing it, not going to happen anytime soon. Okay, so now this piece, allowing the tribes to do it. It's called the hub and spoke system. It's been done in Florida. It's been upheld by federal court. So this probably meets that standard, although Will says there are other issues in Wisconsin that would kind of preclude it. So we'll see. There'd be a court fight, nothing else. There's also a question, do lawmakers have the ability in period to allow this kind of gaming because they are barred by the Constitution to enact gambling, essentially. So there's your lawsuit, essentially they pass this. If it passes, you would have to get the bill passed. It's on the governor who said basically up front this past weekend, he's open to it. If it became law, it would then go to the governor to negotiate compacts that allow this opportunity. Then it would go to the federal government who would have to like sign off through the Bureau of Indian Affairs that say it's all okay. Okay, they're the policy stuff. The political piece of this is the next piece of the onion. Look who's sponsoring this bill. All right, Tyler August is the Assembly Majority Leader who told me last Thursday that he would have at least 50 GOP votes for this bill on the floor. That's a benchmark you want to hit because if you're leader, You don't want to have the minority party to have a say in passing things. It also keeps happy caucus, happy life, right? Other co-sponsors, Howard Markline, co-chair of the Finance Committee, one of the three Republicans being targeted next fall by Democrats to try and flip his seat to the Senate. There's big money involved. The tribes are generous donors. I went back and looked. The Potawatomi, for example, which is one of the most successful tribes in terms of gaming in Wisconsin, they hit the max contribution, PAC contribution to the caucuses, the Republican caucuses, every election cycle. All right? There's an argument that I heard last week from some folks of, look, the tribes don't ask for much. If you don't do this bill, why would they help you come election time next year? Because this is the next frontier again in gaming. You're not going to do it. They might say, hey, we're not going to help you guys. That's important for Devin Lemieux, Seven Drill Leader. He needs resources to help get people elected. If the tribes won't help, will that hurt the cause? Okay. So there's that piece of it. I know it's a long story, but there's a lot going on. This onion is huge. So, will the tribes get involved? Okay. That gets back to that 50 mark I had about the assembly, 17 in the Senate. Lemieux and the Senate Republicans have this rule of 17. It's not a hard, fast rule, but generally speaking, they want 17 GOP votes for anything to pass to avoid having the Democrats having say in things. And two, you avoid irking, to say it lightly, some of your members because they feel like, hey, if I'm not on board, you shouldn't do this. They have 18 members. They can lose one person. In committee, they had two no votes, Rachel Cabral-Rivera and Andre Jacques. If you can get one back on board, okay, you're back at 17. I'm hearing there are more than just those two have concerns. We're seeing Talk Radio Milwaukee kind of tee off on this thing. We're seeing the Will memo. So there's conservative pushback. For Lemieux, and now for the assembly, when push comes to shove, are you going to put that bill on the floor, let's say in February, and say the heck with it? We need to get this done because of not just we think it's good policy, but because of the political implications to knock this thing out. Pressure could build toward those last days to finish it. So that's going to be interesting to watch how that all plays out, if they can get it done, because these are high stakes in the Capitol. And yeah, again, there's policy, there's history, there's this is why I love this story so much. There's all kinds of stuff going on. Oh, and by the way, can't forget that thing about it's not a big ask from the tribes. Republicans will tell you, well, wait a second, there's the Gray Wolf Hunt, there's Line 5, there's closing roads on reservation land that our constituents have used to get their homes. There's a rub between tribes in northern Wisconsin and the Republican base that is not helping the situation at all. So again, many, many onion layers, but that's kind of like what's happening with this bill, why it's a lot of drama going on with it.
And, you know, it's so unusual to see something pulled from the calendar at the last minute, especially something that you know already went through so much work behind the scenes to kind of make it onto the agenda in the first place. And so it's also a little bit of an interesting tell, you know, as Tyler August gets kind of groomed for increased leadership and things like that, that this needed to get kind of pulled back. He said he's not worried about those constitutional questions. It's just because of concerns within his own caucus. He didn't talk about what those concerns were. But it's clear that all of this is kind of at play and this thing is very much alive. So he says it'll come back early next year, and we'll see if that's true.
You should note, it was formally introduced October 29th. It was going to go from introduction to passage in the assembly in 3 weeks. That shows you they're trying to get this thing done quickly before, like, the opposition kind of got its legs under it. This has been thwarted now. The longer you give the opposition to, like, get oxygen, the harder it can be to get something done. So, yeah, it's going to be an interesting challenge for Tyler. And also, this is an early test of his leadership, right? So, Robin Voss, Assembly Speaker, longest-serving speaker in Wisconsin history. You've heard the rumors I have that he's going to be done after this session. We'll see. He's basically said he was not going to run this for this term, but then they tried to recall him, and he said, hey, I'm not the guy who's pushing me out the door, essentially. So we're all kind of like assuming that maybe Robin's not going to run. Well, if Robin's not there, who's going to lead the caucus? It's been Tyler as a person waiting. Here's an early test of his leadership. Can he get this caucus together for a priority that he has?
Also not appearing on the assembly this week was a bill that would have made the state apply to the USDA for a waiver in terms of how it administers SNAP, basically saying that SNAP recipients cannot use their, or here food share recipients cannot use their federal food dollars for candy, soda, energy drinks, things like that. That was also kind of expected to hit the floor. It is popular among Trump allies in particular. It's an RFK Jr. kind of pet project. The idea is essentially that people who are receiving subsidies should not be spending that on unhealthy things, especially if they also use subsidized or public forms of health insurance. Critics say that this criminalizes poverty, especially, you know, right around Christmas time, to tell families that they can't be buying candy is sort of a, that was one of the arguments from Democrats. So I was expecting that to be kind of a big fight on the floor. That also got pulled with kind of little fanfare. Not a lot of clarity as to why. I've reached out to the offices. They haven't really said much. One wonders, you know, during the whole kind of SNAP fight of a couple weeks ago during the shutdown, grocery lobbies, gas station lobbies, all of this are very supportive of SNAP payments because they receive a lot of those dollars when people go grocery shopping at their establishments. So it's possible that those lobbies have been kind of, you know, had a say here. The other thing that did not happen on the floor of the Assembly is Democrats tried to force a vote on a bipartisan proposal that is quite popular among lawmakers of all stripes, which is expanding Medicaid for new mothers from to up to a year after postpartum. And so this is something that, again, both Democrats and Republicans have pushed for. Republicans from a sort of pro-life perspective, Democrats, you know, from their for their own reasons. The person who's really kind of against it is Assembly Speaker Robin Voss.
Basically, Robin has declared it an expansion of welfare, and he is not going to have any of it. That's also been his reason for not doing the expansion of Obamacare through the Affordable Care Act, or Medicaid through the Affordable Care Act. It's expansion of welfare. Robin is a lonely voice in this discussion, but Robin also wields huge influence over his caucus. So they are not going to, as much as I love the bill, go out of their way to assist Democrats in forcing a vote. Now, push comes to shove again late February, we'll see what happens, but Dems tried this kind of like little procedural maneuver to kind of force it on the floor. Robin found a way to kind of thwart that. There's a little bit of a side drama because the Assembly Chief Clerk, he kind of notified Robin Voss this was coming, gave him some time to prepare. He wasn't supposed to do that, so that's a side issue. What I'm watching for here is people like Pat Schneider, Republican from Weston. He has said basically, if I can't get this done, why am I here? Pat is in a key seat. There are about five or six really kind of 50-50 seats in the Assembly. His is like just beyond that, in part because of him. He's been around for a long time. He won re-election easily, this new seat in 2024. If Pat's not there, it makes it a little bit harder. So what I'm watching is there a way that Robin relents, which would be unusual. Robin Voss is pretty consistent about the way positions he takes. And if he doesn't, what's that do for people like Pat who might say, you know, this is the camel broke the straws, or the straw broke the camel's back. Sorry for butchering that analogy. But I'm watching that if they somehow say, you know what, we're going to go around Robin. I haven't seen that yet. That'd be an interesting break with the caucus, with leadership, and it'd be a tough one. But in the Senate, passed 32-1. And if you put on the floor of the Assembly right now with no restrictions on how you vote, nope, I'm sure it would pass three-fourths majority, if not more, in the Assembly. That shows you the power of one person in that chamber.
And, you know, Democrats have also been making a little bit of hay of the drama on the floor of trying to get it forward, you know, on social media and kind of drawing attention to it there. And so it'll also be interesting to see if that becomes an election issue and needing to kind of, you know, each side kind of wanting to use it as a form of leverage or to take away leverage from the other side with those debates.
My guess is the Mail piece will say, like, Republicans hate new moms. It won't say, like, expand welfare or more benefits, but it'll be something like that. You know, they're creative in that the way that the other mailers that way.
Lots of messaging. All right, let's talk a little bit about what actually did happen at the legislature. Again, dozens of bills in both the Senate and the Assembly. The Assembly was a little bit thematic, so they had a series of bills around school consolidation. So this has become a bit of a focus for Republicans, this idea that enrollment, I believe, has gone down in public schools by about 50,000 students in the last decade. And so a series of bills that would offer kind of financial incentives for schools to look at merging schools or classes, and then also a slate of bills related to elections, although noticeably not the Monday processing bill. So that happened in the Assembly. And we will, I guess, take a little bit of a look just to start at the debate around the election bills that don't include Monday processing.
My esteemed colleague in the 72nd, went on a bit of a media tour everywhere, telling everybody that he was going to fix this, that he was going to get this done. I'll quote from him. He said, the people want to know who won the election, damn election, before they go to bed. This amendment would do that. This amendment would enable clerks to be able to process those ballots ahead of time and therefore get those election results that my own colleague says people want to know before they go to bed.
We already know we have a safe and secure and fair process. We can make it better with 21st century technologies. We can make it better with conversation and collaboration. So we dealt with smurfing today. We dealt with observer issues today. We're dealing with absentee ballot requests to submission. We're dealing with early voting. I mean, you look at the list of things we got done today that are heading to the state Senate. There's still more time for that conversation to happen until the Senate takes these up.
So there's been bipartisan support for Monday processing, but we found out a couple weeks ago that there was just not enough support among Republicans, again, this kind of rule of 50 question. And so there was a whole host of other things that were passed, but Democrats continue to kind of push back. And it looks like almost nothing that did go forward, including, you know, banning mobile absentee ballot drop sites and kind of shoring up some regulations on election observers and things like this, probably most of them will not survive in Evers' veto.
If you see a party line vote on anything election related, it's not going anywhere the governor, put it that way.
Yeah, so that was the Assembly. And then over at the Senate, it was a little bit more of a spaghetti at the wall kind of session, I would say. But some of the notable ones, there was a vote to end the per pupil adjustment of $325 per pupil for 400 years. Folks might remember that kind of budget line item veto. Something around kind of shoring up free speech on UW campuses. There was a big debate about funding for healthcare for unlawfully present individuals. That's a thing. Unlawfully present individuals do not receive public health care, but this was kind of a formal ban on that. And then, again, one of the really big debates of the day was a bill that would restrict the definition of abortion, so essentially saying that miscarriage management is not the same thing as abortion, even though often a lot of the same sort of medical procedures are used. And again, we have some debate on the floor from that.
Abortion is overwhelmingly safe. And it is really important for women to be able to choose that, if that's the right thing for their health, for their family. But this bill will instead push physicians to force women to have unnecessary C-sections or to induce delivery rather than providing them with abortion. You're going to compound that horrible day by preventing her from getting the health care she needs or making that doctor think twice before providing her the frontline care that is the standard of care.
Women facing the heartbreaking situation of needing to remove a stillborn child is not an abortion. Women needing medical attention for a miscarriage is not an abortion. Women facing an ectopic pregnancy or other similar situations where a child is developing in a manner that is not conducive to life will not be stopped from getting the care that they need. Senate Bill 553 does not ban abortion. Senate Bill 553 does not restrict access to abortion. Senate Bill 553 simply reinforces current law to define and clarify that life-saving medical care for pregnant women is clearly distinguished from elective abortions. Intent matters.
So again, this is one of those bills that is incredibly unlikely to survive an Evers veto, but it points to this kind of national argument around abortion. And while there's the debate in the courts and in the state around, you know, it's restricted to 20 weeks, all of this kind of thing, it's a bit of an attempt to restrict abortion kind of from these like outer angles in a way that is also responsive to what is happening in the rest of the country where, you know, some people have been, medical providers have been criminalized for providing medical care related to pregnancy because it comes a little too close to abortion.
Going back to the property tax bill, a little timing theme there, the Senate, a little bit of a hodgepodge, but they're tying that because if you're a homeowner, you should see a property tax bill in about 3 or 4 weeks, show up in your mailbox. They want to make this argument that it's Governor Evers' fault, your property taxes are going up. Democrats make the argument, no, it's the Republicans' fault, they put more state aid in the formula. That'll be the messaging battle next year in the election about your property taxes. Whose fault was it? your bill jumped so much.
So again, lots of debate, lots of things going on this week. There was also a decision in a lawsuit about wedding barns. So again, last session, so a couple years ago now, there was a kind of huge overhaul of state alcohol laws. And one of the consequences of this was a change to how wedding barns, so barns that are that act as a wedding venue, can or cannot kind of distribute liquor. So people like to drink at weddings. Mm-hmm. This is huge news. And what this essentially did was say that wedding barns needed to either get a liquor license or they needed to set it up so that the whoever was renting from them had to provide their own beer and wine. And so these wedding barn owners sued. They said that this violated their constitutional rights to make a living, that essentially this made it impossible for them to run a successful business. And then the judge in this case, he ruled in a kind of interesting way. He ruled that this was in the state's interest to kind of regulate how much people are drinking, and that with this law coming through, that it essentially helps prevent overconsumption.
It may be a shock to people that there's an interest Wisconsin has in cutting down on excessive drinking, because what we see at Packer games and Badger games and everything else we go to in Wisconsin. But yes, so essentially these wedding barns, two of them, one said it would do like 26 events a year, though in 18. They're now saying they can't get any because there's like a license you can get to have six a year, one per month at max, and six overall. We can't survive on that, they say. For the Tavern League, which is a big proponent of this change, say it's not fair. Like, how can you allow these folks to have a wedding barn where people bring in, a caterer brings in all the alcohol? There's self-service. Been a few of those in my time. There's no regulation of who's drinking, who's checking on who's drinking. That's not fair. That's a push, but for the wedding barns, it basically means you're likely going out of business unless you get a local alcohol license.
And then also this week, speaking of sort of costs going up, the Public Service Commission announced rate hikes for energy and utility bills. So $304.5 million in higher rates on electric and natural gas bills over the next 2 years. In total, this will kick in January 1st, 2027. We got the numbers from Excel and Alliant, mm-hmm. And I believe that you are still waiting on a callback from MG&E to see about their rate hikes.
So this is all pertinent, and well, one, people are paying more costs for the utilities, but two, look what happened in New Jersey, especially in the governor's race. Utility costs were a huge issue. We're in an affordability crunch right now. Here is an example of the affordability crunch. The PSC, when it takes up rate cases, sometimes it's a settlement, they call it, where all the parties who are contesting it get on board and say, we like this. And so in one of these cases, there was kind of an agreement that, yes, this is appropriate. There's going to be scrutiny, though, of these rate cases because costs are going up. A year ago, and these kind of go on a cycle, two-year cycle, a year ago they approved like $683 million, roughly, in new rate increases. Here, the PSC voted actually three weeks ago. It took them until Monday of this week to confirm for us what they did, because they break it up into like dozens of smaller votes. They took a week and a half to crunch the numbers, make sure like what they actually did, what the impact was. So Madison Gas Electric today, much smaller proposed increase, but it might take, that vote was yesterday, maybe end of the week or early next week, we'll find out what they did. But overall, your costs are going up. The hitch is, under state law, you must give the utilities an increase to cover their costs and give them the opportunity for investors to have a profit. Unless you change state law, you're not going to decrease those costs. There has definitely been an uptick in the approval of rates under Governor Evers' picks for the PSC compared to Scott Walker. That's driven part by inflation. It costs more for steel, which builds utility poles that they have to put up for lines. Like, that's part of it driving it. The cost of gas is higher than it was 10 years ago. That said, I expect this to be an issue in the election next fall for governor for sure.
And one final topic this week, the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, the kind of conservative pro-business lobby, has filed another lawsuit against the DNR on an innocent landowners provision. This is separate from the PFAS kind of negotiations that we've seen over the last couple of years, but it's about these a spills law. So essentially that people who buy properties where there has been contamination are on the hook for cleaning it up, even if they are not responsible for the spill. And so this is the latest lawsuit that essentially says says if I buy a parcel of land, I should not be, you know, responsible for the crimes of the people coming before. The DNR has been handed a victory in this area with PFAS in the past, saying essentially that to be too sort of generous to innocent landowners would let polluters off the hook. And so it'll be interesting to see if this is just the same fight over a different type of contamination and how that plays out.
There's an interesting connection that spills law to an abortion bill being circulated right now by Republicans that says if you are prescribed an abortion pill, you'd have to get a catch kit, essentially, that when you go home that you catch the, I can't remember what your proper term was for it, but what happens after this to ensure it's not getting the water system, the water supply, these drugs. And if you did get it in there, if there was a detection of these drugs in the water supply, the manufacturer of the abortion pill would be on the hook for the spills law, have to mitigate the impact.
Everything is a little bit mixed together here. Another big onion, I guess.
Yes.
Before we go, I will say we will not see everyone next week. We will be off for the Thanksgiving holiday, but we will see everyone again in 2 weeks. Looking forward to it. I am Ani Van Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
See you in 2 weeks.
Yes.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
Rewind. Your Week in Review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.